Father, I pray for your presence and your spirit and your power to speak. Speak through your word. Speak to our hearts. Thank you. And I pray that in Jesus' name. Amen. God does some strange things sometimes. Mm-hmm. He doesn't always work the way we think he should work. Right? How many of you have seen that? So you're nodding your heads. And when I say that as a statement, generically, as a doctrine, so to speak, everybody nods their heads and says, oh, yeah, that's true, as if we understand. And then God gives you this wonderful job that you love, only to take it away a month later. Or you pray for a child, and 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 God gives you a child who miscarries. And then you say, God, what are you doing? Well, wait a minute. Didn't you just nod your head when I said God doesn't always work the way we think he should work? But when you're the one going through the difficulty, we seem to sort of forget that God doesn't always work the way we think he should work. And it's easy to nod your head at the statement when the heat's not turned up. But turn up the heat and we somehow forget what we know. Now, David had this experience, and we're going to talk about that some in Psalm 60 today. I'm going to start just by reading the preface to the psalm. It says, to the choir master, according to Shushan Eduth, a miktam of David for instruction, when he strove with Aram Naharaim and with Aram Zobah, and when Joab, on his return, struck down 12,000 of Edom in the Valley of Salt. Okay, this preface gives us the context for this psalm. And if you want to look up the context, it's in 2 Samuel chapter 8. And so you could go to 2 Samuel 8 and read about David doing battle in these places and so on. But here's the context. David is now king. So he's done running in the desert with Saul and for this particular psalm. And what's going on is David has become powerful, and the nations next to Israel don't like that. They feel threatened. And so he is going against up north. Aram, in the Bible, Aram is roughly Damascus, Syria, it's up north. Naharaim just means rivers. And so Aram Naharaim and Aram Zobah is up north. He's up there with his armies and he's fighting. While he's up fighting up north, Edom, which is way down south, south of the Dead Sea, says all the armies are way up north, this is our chance, and they invade Judah down south. And David receives message way up north, Edom is attacking way down south, and he's got it on two different fronts, and he sends Joab. Joab is his commander now. So David used to be the military commander for King Saul, but this has changed now. David's now the king. Joab is his military commander. He sends his military commander with another one named Abishai down south to attack Edom. And that's what's going on during the time David's writing this psalm. So, let me read the psalm now. Now that you've got the picture of what's going on, here's what David says while that's going on. Oh God, you have rejected us, broken our defenses. You have been angry. Oh, restore us. You have made the land to quake. You have torn it open. Repair its breaches, for it totters. You have made your people see hard things. You have given us wine to drink that makes us stagger. You have set up a banner for those who fear you, that they may flee to it from the bow, that your beloved ones may be delivered. Give salvation by your right hand and answer us. God has spoken in his holiness. With exultation I will divide up Shechem and portion out the valley of Sukkoth. Gilead is mine. Manasseh is mine. Ephraim is my helmet. Judah is my scepter. Moab is my washbasin. Upon Edom I cast my shoe. Over Philistia I shout in triumph. Who will bring me to the fortified city? Who will lead me to Edom? Have you not rejected us, O God? You do not go forth, O God, with our armies. O grant us help against the foe, for vain is the salvation of man. With God we shall do valiantly. It is he who will tread down our foes. This psalm is divided into three different sections, roughly. I say roughly because there are ideas that are repeated in the different, in multiple sections. And so it's not as if we have a perfect separation of ideas. There's things that it's kind of messy. And yet there really are three different sections to this psalm. So generally speaking, here's the divisions. Verses 1 through 5 describe the situation. David's just saying what's going on. Now, there's other stuff in there, but that's generally what's going on in verses 1 through 5. Verses 6 through 8 give a picture of God's sovereignty over the situation. Verses 9 through 12 describe David's seeking and trusting God in the situation. So, let's look at the text. So we'll start just with that first section. And the first thing I want you to do in the first section is highlight these words. Verse 1. You have rejected us. Verse 1. You have been angry. Verse 2. You have made. Also verse 2. You have torn it open. Verse 3. You have made. You have given. Verse 4. You have set up. You have, you have, you have, you have, you have, you have, you have. You see it everywhere in there, don't you? So, what's the idea? You have. What's the idea? What's David saying there? Live question.
You're in charge. It's you who did it.
God, you did this.
Mm-hmm. You did this, yeah.
Okay. What did God do? Here's verses 1, 2, and 3. He's rejected us. He's been angry. He's made the land quake. He's torn it open. He's made his people see hard things. He's given them wine to drink that makes them stagger. This is a description of what's going on with the battle that David is having to deal with. It's not going well. The battle's not going well, guys. It's going against David and his armies. David sees God in this battle. But what David is seeing is failure. We're failing. David is probably seeing a lot of men die. That's the way battles work. And he's seeing Syrian armies advance. And then he gets a message. Oh, Edom has attacked down south. while you were away. And he has to send Joab down to Edom with an army to deal with the Edomites. And to David, God did this. He says it seven times. God did this. So, does God do this? Does God lead you into battle only to have you lose? Does God call you to something just to have it fail? I guess part of the answer to that question depends on what you mean by fail. See, on one level, I really don't believe you can fail if you are in God's will. If you're doing His will, I don't think you really will fail, ultimately. But I do believe you can fail. God can lead you into failure from an earthly perspective. If you're doing God's will, you may fail the way earth measures success. In other words, it can look like you're failing because of all the externals. Let me give you some examples. And we're going to start with the biggest example of all, the cross. Was it God's will for Jesus to go to the cross? It was. Jesus even brought that up in Gethsemane, right? Not your will, but mine, you know. If it be possible in your will. He's talking about God's will. And it was God's will for Jesus to go to the cross. So, here is Jesus carrying out God's will, and he dies. Now, from an earthly perspective, that death looks like a failure. And there are perhaps disciples who initially thought that. And there are non-Christians today who will say that the cross was a great failure. It was the ultimate failure of Jesus. Christians don't say that because we know what happened. But non-Christians will say that because it looks that way to them. Or Muslims today totally deny that Jesus ever even went to the cross because to do so would have been a failure. That's how they think. These people who say that see the cross only from an earthly perspective. They don't know what really went on at the cross. They just see a man died. And normally we would say that's a failure. And that's how they take it. But here's the deal. That failure, so to speak, was the greatest victory the world has ever seen. That failure is your redemption. Yes, God sometimes leads you and calls you to do things where if you're in His will, it may look like failure. You know, God called us to Austin 25 years ago. We came with the Christian and Missionary Alliance originally for a church plant with the CMA. That church closed. So did God call me to do that? He did. I know He did. Well, why would He call me to something just to close it? Believe me, I've asked that question many times. I'm not here saying, you know, like I got this. But first, that's what brought us to Austin in the first place. Second, that's where we actually began international ministry, was through that. The international ministry came actually out of what we were doing with the CMA. Third, that's where the vision, the church vision came from, you know, for house churches and whatnot. And that failure, so to speak, kept me coming back to God. Guys, sometimes we actually need to fail at earthly things for the sake of heavenly things. A broken relationship, a poor job review from your boss, a bad grade in class, you know, I didn't do so well in that class, the loss of your income, a health failure. God uses these kinds of things to build men and to build women. And sometimes we have to let go of earth. And often the best way for us to let go of earth is to fail at earth. And then you start letting go of it. And when you start letting go of earth, God's got you where he wants you. That's what he wants from you. He's not interested in the earthly stuff that you failed at, so to speak. He's interested in what that does to your heart. He's interested in you more than he is in whatever the issue happens to be. And so sometimes we got to go through that. And maybe God will even lead you right into it. And then sometimes these earthly failures are really just temporary. It is a failure for now, but God uses that, you know, God, the story continues. So, for example, God appears to Moses in a burning bush, and God says to Moses, "Go tell Pharaoh to let my people go." And so Moses, obviously, you know, in the beginning he complains and no, I can't, you got the wrong guy and all of that. But eventually, you know, he goes, he obeys. And he goes to Pharaoh and he says, "Let my people go." And what does Pharaoh do? He says, "You Jews, you're lazy. That's why you want to go. So I tell you what we're going to do now. I'm not letting you go, but since you have all this time on your hands, the quota of bricks stays the same, but you got to gather your own straw now." Oh, guys, Moses just obeyed God and made things a lot worse by obeying God. Now, if you're Moses, you know you're wondering, "Lord, why? Why? I did what you said. Why did it get worse when I did what you said?" But God doesn't always work the way we think he should. Right? But of course, if you're Moses in the middle of that situation, you forgot about that. You know he forgot about it. You know he's asking those questions. To Moses, it looks as if he messed up. But here's, guys, God's only getting started. Because we know the rest of the story, right? That's not the end of the story. The story continues, and, you know, we get frogs and hail and all the plagues and a Passover and you know, a Red Sea parting, and we get, there's a lot more story to go, but right now, if you're Moses right in that moment, it looks like you failed. Okay, in Psalm 60, David's armies are losing. It is not going well. But the story isn't over. You can lose battles and win wars. And David is not going to quit because we're losing. Because it looks like God's rejected us and things are not going well. He is going to seek God. And he seeks God all throughout this psalm. Look at verse 1. In verse 1, he says, "You've rejected us, broken our defenses, been angry." And then he says, "Oh, restore us." It just sort of comes out spontaneous, you know, in verse 1. Look at verse 2. "Repair its breaches." Look at verse 5. give salvation by your right hand and answer us. Look at verse 11. O grant us help against the foe, for vain is the salvation of man. So here's the thing. David is seeking a God whom he believes has rejected him. Look at verse 1. You have rejected us, broken our defenses. You have, God, you have done this, and I'm going to seek you anyway. Go to verses 9 and 10. He says, who will bring me to the fortified city? Who will lead me to Edom? Have you not rejected us, O God? You do not go forth, O God, with our armies. The very next verse, verse 10, says, grant us help against the foe. So here's the flow. The flow is, Lord, you've rejected us. You're not with us. Help us. That seems kind of odd on one level. David is sticking with God when he says God is not sticking with him. Can you do that? See, God hasn't brought whatever. God hasn't brought the healing that you want. Will you stick with him anyway? God took your spouse to be with him. Despite your prayers, will you stick with God anyway? God did not give you the job you wanted. You going to stick with him? He allowed your friends to abandon you. He allowed you to suffer when you honored him. You honored God and you suffered because of it. Will you stick with him anyway? This is what David's facing. He's facing a God who he says has rejected me, but he says, I'm still sticking with that God. See, I think this is something God likes. He likes this. He wants you to stay with him when you don't understand. He wants you to stick with him when life does not go your way. He wants you to trust him for the future. The present is pretty messy. It looks bad. But God wants you to stay with him and trust him for what's coming. But a lot of people, when they're in that situation, quit. They just quit. I'm done with this God. If this is how God is, I don't want anything to do with him. That's how I've heard lots of people say that. They say God didn't do anything for me. As if they are the whole point. Guys, never quit on God. Never quit on living in holiness. Never quit resisting Satan. Never quit in the spiritual life. Don't ever quit, ever. I don't care how it's going. You never quit. It looks as if he's rejecting you. It looks as if all of life is against you. It looks as if you'll never shake your fears, as if you'll never be free from this sin. Never quit on God. Fight the sin in Christ, and don't give up. If you're going to follow God, you're all in. There's no halfway. I'm going to follow God halfway, kind of. You know, some people do this. They follow God halfway to see if he will give them what they want. To see what God can do for me. I'll try him out and see what he can do for me. That's kind of halfway following God, which isn't following God. If you bail out on God because he didn't come through for you, you were never following him in the first place. You were using him to get what you wanted. You wanted something else, and you thought God might be a good way to get what you really wanted. That's not following God. That's following what you really want. And God is just a tool that you're using. Following God halfway is not following God. It's like being married halfway. That doesn't even make sense. There is no such thing as being married halfway. And there is no such thing as following God halfway. When you truly follow God and it looks as if he's rejecting you, go back to God. Even if it looks like he's rejecting you, even if it looks like he's messing with your mind or whatever, that is what David is doing in this psalm. He's running back to God in the midst of, you're rejecting us, you're angry with us, you've made us see hard things, where are you? And he's going right back to God. Now, he's doing that because he knows God. He knows who he is. Verse 11. Grant us help against the foe. That's where he's going to God. For, this is the reason why. Vain is the salvation of man. By contrast, what David is implying is God's salvation is not vain. Man's salvation is empty, worthless, vain. Man is powerless to give me real salvation, but God has power. I can go to him for salvation. He's saying, who else can I go to? I can't go to man. Guys, your brother is not going to save you. Your best friend, he's not going to save you. Your government isn't going to save you. Your co-workers, they're not going to save you. These people don't have God's power. They are just as weak as you are. You say, you're in trouble, and then you turn to somebody who's just as strong as you for help. God's the one that's got the power. When you talk about God, now you're talking about someone who can really deliver power, who can give you help. And he's the one who can ultimately bring salvation. When it looks hopeless, and when it seems as if he hasn't been much help at all, you still go to him. Because he's God. And because he's sovereign. That's really the point of verses 6 through 8, the sovereignty of God in this situation. I'm just going to read those verses. God has spoken in his holiness. With exultation, I will divide up Shechem and portion out the valley of Sukkot. Gilead is mine. Manasseh is mine. Ephraim is my helmet. Judah is my scepter. Moab is my washbasin. Upon Edom I cast my shoe. Over Philistia I shout in triumph. This is David's little interlude in the psalm. This is God is speaking in those verses. The rest of the psalm, David is speaking, but in those verses, God is speaking. And the whole thing deals with who God is. God has spoken in his holiness. And what I want you to notice in verses 6 through 8 is all of the references to the first person. Here we have, I, God says, I will divide up, and I will portion out, and mine, mine, my, 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 I cast my shoe, I shout in triumph. You see, it's kind of like, it's like bricks hitting you in the head with what God is saying, mine and mine and my and my. God owns them. The emphasis in those verses is on God. Verses 6 and 7, God owns Israel. All those places are Israel. Gilead, Manasseh, Shechem is a city, the valley of Succoth, Ephraim, Judah, Israel. God owns Israel. He's saying they're his. By parallel, today, God owns the church, which means he owns you. He owns you. Sometimes we don't like that because we don't, especially Americans. Americans, we're independent. Independent people don't like to be owned. God owns you. He could just as easily say, Leah is mine. Day-Day is mine. David is my helmet. You know, you could just put names in there. And that's the idea. If you put your name in there, you're getting the idea. You need to see it that way. You're his. Oh, so it looks like he's rejecting you? You still go to him. You're his. God owns his people. Then, verse 8, he gives them victory over the nations. Moab is not Israel, nor is Edom, nor is Philistia. Those are some of the nations that are around. And so he owns Israel, and then he gives them victory over these nations. That's the picture that God is giving to David. And in this psalm, David is at war against these nations. And he's losing. But he's declaring that God will be victorious over the nations. He says that in verse 8, where God is saying, Moab is my washbasin. Edom, over Edom I cast my shoe. It's just like almost like contempt. Throw my shoe to those guys. Philistia, I shout in triumph. Verse 12, jump down there. David then concludes the psalm with God, we shall do valiantly. Hear that. They're losing right now. But with God, we shall do valiantly. It is he who will tread down our foes. We will have victory, he's saying, in God. This is the sovereignty of God. Now, people approach the sovereignty of God in different ways. Some see their sufferings and their failures, and they blame God because he's sovereign. This failure is due to the sovereignty of God, and so God is sovereign, and I'm going to blame him, and I'm going to have nothing to do with him now because look what he did to me. David could have done that. Lots of people do that. But others see the same sufferings and the same failures, and they run to God because he can actually do something about them. Run to him. I want to apply that text this way. The second way, the sovereignty of God means not you blame him, but you run to him. You find encouragement in the sovereignty of God, not discouragement in the sovereignty of God. Now, David was fighting a war, and it was not going real well. And you and I today, we're not fighting wars, at least. We're not fighting, you know, guns and those kind of wars. But you are fighting wars. What is the war you're fighting? So, for example, for me, and I shared this with these guys, I've been sharing this with these guys for a while, I'm fighting a war for more time in prayer. That's a war. That's not something that just, oh yeah, let's, that's a war. And you, what's the war? Prayer? Fear, whatever your fears are, you fight those wars. Worry, letting go of money, lust, how you treat your spouse, your kids, or maybe a real battle with some coworker or a family member where there's real conflict going on. We have these things. You've got this battle, probably multiple battles. You're wrestling with it, you're fighting it. Maybe it even looks like God's been rejecting you. It's not going so well. Run to God. And never quit. You're in this battle till you die, if that's what it takes. You don't ever quit. What I want to do is, I want you to pray and ask God for grace that you will not quit, and that He will give victory in whatever the battle happens to be. And so I'm just going to give us a time to do that for about a minute on your own. Think of whatever that battle is that you've got, and I want you to be praying for God's grace to continue the fight and to run to Him.